Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate. This week's guest is Daniel Sanderson. I was able to meet Daniel in a cracking place that most people in Liverpool will know called the Baltic Social. It was great to chat to Daniel. Daniel is one of the founders of Mundial magazine, which brings together football and culture. And he's had some fantastic additions out already. I think they're up to the 11th one, and David Beckham's the cover star this time. And they've also had excellent work with Andrea Pirlo and obviously they covered the genius that is Maradona quite recently. It's well worth getting stuck into. And you can probably, if you're listening to this, you'll have had Mundial magazine retweeted into your timeline at some point. They really are quite excellent. And it was great to meet Daniel. He's been, again, another big help for someone who is still feeling his way around this type of stuff. So it was good to meet him. It's probably been pointed out on this podcast before that I am an Evertonian. So to have two Liverpool-centric memories was quite interesting. We'll say... Daniel is quite softly spoken, and because of that, you will need probably earphones or to turn your speakers right up. His memory talks about, well, I'd like to say that forever, like Daniel, you'll end up thinking of Attilio Lombardo the same way. But he talked about how he kind of ultimately, I think what we get out of it is that how going to Anfield and going to the match as a young lad has basically formed his view of football now. And his moments, Liverpool, they won a trophy in 2005. I'm not sure if you've heard about it. It's not like they've gone on about it at all. I know Daniel talks about how his love for Vladimir Smicha's goal in the 2005, the 2005 Champions League final, where Liverpool obviously did Istanbul. And what I hope comes through quite a lot in Daniel's two part of the podcast is how much family have formed his love of football and how he is used again now. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed getting over to chat to him and meet him, and we urge you to like, subscribe and rate. Anyway, on with the podcast. I hope you enjoy.
It wasn't my first game at watching Liverpool, but it was definitely one of them. I can't remember exactly my first game, but it was on the back row of the car with my dad, and we played Crystal Palace when Lombardo was player manager, I think. And we drew, I can't remember, it was 1-1 or 0-0, and two really young lads in front of us booed Liverpool off the pitch.
And that, I mean, in the past few years, just as the sun comes out, yeah, into your face, sorry, in the past few years there has been a bit of booing, and the standards almost have changed as the supporter changes, really, isn't it? And what was that a surprise to you when you first heard it?
It wasn't. I was probably too young to understand the idea of, like, oh, you know, we're Liverpool, we don't boo our teams off or whatever. But the fella who was next to my dad on our row just clipped them both around the back of the head and kind of told them that's not what we do here. And yeah, it isn't. It maybe isn't the case anymore. But back then there was this kind of idea that, yeah, Liverpool didn't boo their team, even if they were drawing with Crystal Palace, and you'd expect them to win.
Is that something that's good for the team? Now we move into this idea where supporters pay their money,
yeah,
and not customers, but supporters pay the money. Is there something behind that? Would you boo? Have you ever booed?
I don't think I have. I've never booed Liverpool. I've booed opposition, but I've never booed Liverpool. I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing, or whether the game's changed and it's expected in certain quarters now. But it's just always kind of seen as something that weirdos did. It was a bit panto to kind of boo your own team, and you meant to get behind them even if you are getting, you know, not to the extent of like we do all the time now and saying you'll never walk alone whenever we're drawing. But yeah, you don't turn on your team, I think was quite an important lesson learned there.
And that's the point. How much of an impact have you gone on during your Liverpool supporting life? How much of an impact has that had on you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's kind of, that moment has sort of shaped what I think it is, or what, you know, what's to be expected of that moment and others, but it, you know, what you're meant to act like and how you're meant to conduct yourself at the match and how you're meant to support your team. It's probably a bit of an arrogance thing from Liverpool's point of view, or kind of like we think we're better fans than other people, but in that sense, I do think it is a good quality that, you know, if you were told not to boo your team, I don't think that's something you should be doing.
As you come away from that, and as a kid, what was the best thing about it? Literally watching one fella clock, another fella, and you got to see it for free.
It was funny. I remember thinking it was funny, but there was definitely, like, it's over 20 years ago now, and I remember it. So it wasn't just like a funny memory. It must have meant something. Like, I must have taken stock of it and thought, bloody hell, like, that's, you know, I won't be doing that. I won't be booing, like, at Anfield. So there's something I took away from it, as well as it being quite a funny thing to say.
that's always a big help, really, isn't it? Is that you kind of get an idea. I mean, I'm, you know, as you know, I'm an Evertonian, and my first real games going was like we were bad. I mean, yeah. We were really bad. But you kind of you don't necessarily mean. One of the first podcasts we did was with Ian McIntosh, and he said he doesn't really recall much happening on the pitch.
Oh, no.
And is it the stands? What happens in the stands? Is that what forms a young fan's view of the game?
I think so. I can't, apart from the fact that Lombardo was Crystal Palace, like, that's just a weird anomaly that I remember. I don't remember the result. I know it was a draw. I don't remember who scored, or if we scored at all. I don't remember anything. I couldn't name who played for us at the time. It was probably like Jamie Redknapp kind of era. I remember that, and some of my best memories of going with my dad are from like outside the ground, and like the weirdos selling the badges, and the smell of police all shit and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's all those things, and we say this a lot at Mundial. It's kind of like the football actually does get in the way of a good day out more often than not, and you kind of remember all the things around it, and the relationships you build are 10 times more important than what happens on the pitch. It's great to win, it's great to see your side win, but everything else is the stuff you remember.
I have generally had this thought in the past that without them intending to, the biggest getting of the people around you, football crowd, is in Life of Brian. When they're booing the Gladiator, and then they start having the conversations, and there's factions in the stands and stuff. I always maintain that's a good way of doing it. Did your love of Liverpool, did that form very, very early on?
Yeah, it's a strange one, this, because we in various jobs I've had and being abroad and kind of being based in London and stuff, you're like, oh, you know, how long have you supported Liverpool for, and stuff like that. I'm like, well, there was never a choice I made. Like, it was not something that, you know, I've started supporting us when we started winning things, because we weren't very good in, like, when I was a kid, we weren't great. I just wasn't Liverpool supporter. My dad had decided that kind of well before I was born, I assume. It was a love, but it was like, you know, it was forced, and like it's something that you have to, when they're bad, you kind of wish you didn't have it, you know what I mean? It's like, oh god, like I've got to support these, like I haven't got a choice. I do love them. It's really annoying. Like I've got to watch Liverpool. I've got to want Liverpool to win. Like I said, it gets in the way of your life.
Is that how you think you've ended up going down? The route that you've done with certainly with Mundial, which is, you know, the first few times, I must admit, the first time I ever read a Mundial, I was like, is there any footy coming in this? but I understand that's kind of, football has evolved now, really, in a way that people can enjoy whole aspects of it without being labelled weirdos or...
Yeah.
And is that ultimately drawn out of, does that come out the well of the pre-match... rituals of fans?
Yeah, probably to an extent. I mean, we probably are weirdos as well, and I think that's important to say, in to some extent. But I think there's so many facets of football that you can consume now, and everything from stats and heat maps, right, you know, right down to fan culture, and there's that, none of that's bad. It's for different people. It's a sport that can be kind of broken down in that way. So when we set out to do this, we didn't think there was anyone out there doing what we're doing and kind of talking about the things we're talking about. There's loads of great magazines, there's loads of great podcasts, there's, you know, the Sky Sports News serves a purpose for certain people who want to consume football in that way. But yeah, we wanted to do it this way, and we wanted to do it with a little bit of a sense of humour, and yeah, kind of talking about the things that we enjoy alongside football. The front section of the magazine's like, it's got bits on kind of podcast and Channel 4 series that we're watching and things we've bought off eBay. There's not a lot of football, you're right, but it's all kind of tied around, you know, tied into that aspect of it. It's a social thing, and it's the game kind of ties all those aspects of our lives together.
It's possibly a natural evolution of the fanzine, really, isn't it? I would say that When Skies Are Grey, mm-hmm. which I think is probably with maybe the Mud Hutter. Was it the Stoke fanzine? You know, they're at the best for me. They were always at their best when the team itself was utter shite. And you think that people can go, well, you know, certainly in the late 90s, as you say, that wasn't the best Liverpool side. Mm. It was moving towards a very good Liverpool side. Yeah. But I think the season you're talking about is 97-98, because Palace beat Everton in the first game of the season. Okay. Lombardo scored the winner. And it was when the Premier League was starting to attract all these players, and it was, you know, it was mad situations where you'd see really well-known players turning up in mad places. I think last beaten by Wencambiasso, one of the best midfielders ever, turns up at Leicester. So do you think that your memory has formed your view of football from that way? When did it become more about the cultural aspect rather than the footballing aspect, do you think?
That's a tough one. I suppose it's when you become aware that it's a cultural aspect and it's not just what you're doing, and probably in my teenage years I started discovering these fanzines from, you know, the Liverpool One Boss, and the End book got released, and there's no doubt that we kind of just ripped them off wholesale. And when Skies Are Grey, like, it's the best. I don't enjoy reading a lot of it because it's just kind of slagging me off, but it's as good as it gets, and the fact that it's stuck around for so long is testament to that. And I think it was when kind of discovering these things and realizing that people were writing it down, documenting it. I was like, oh, this is something. This is not just what you know, the day to day, and like, oh, you got a match and it's interesting, and the cultural aspect of it was being documented and it's being written down. You can go back and look through all these things and see where before mainstream media were anywhere near it, like where these kind of ideas formed, and the idea that going to the match wasn't just consuming a sport. It was something much bigger than that.
When did you think that? When was the last time you think then that you were actually engrossed in a game?
I was watching against Maribor in the weekend. That was typical. It just wasn't very insistent in the game at all. When we played Hoffenheim, when we were back in Europe, when we were back, it looked like we were going to be back in the Champions League. That was kind of important. I think it's like a milestone game like that, and if you feel like it, you know, there's something hanging on it, and we're playing well. The Dortmund game where we beat them at Anfield as well. That was kind of, in inverted commas, one of those famous nights at Anfield kind of thing. Yeah. Like it felt like there was something, about it, and it wasn't necessarily the quality of the football. It was just like kind of like we needed to win it.
Yeah,
we needed to win it, and that's when you sit up and pay attention a little bit more, I suppose.
I mean, I'm of the same generation of you, even though I think there's a decent age gap between us, that because we've missed glory years, we're being ingrained into us that these glory years have got to come back, but but there's a detachment between the people who were there first time round and their view of the second time round or the third time round, or the, how many false dawns certainly both clubs have been through.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's kind of growing up. I suppose I was born in 88, but it just sort of started going wrong for us.
Yeah.
Pretty much, so like, as I was born, Liverpool went on a downturn for 10, 15 years, and my uncles and my dad and stuff, who've obviously seen us win everything, it was weird for them, and they probably sort of removed, stepped back a little bit from going to West Liverpool, because compared to, they probably weren't, you know what I mean? We were in the Premier League, we were playing European football and stuff, but as far as they were concerned, we weren't winning the European Cup, so it wasn't good enough. And there's definitely a detachment between those two generations, my generation and the older one. But I think that's natural, and I think the games, you know, changed so massively in that period that they're never gonna feel as they did in the 80s or in the 70s, because it's never gonna go back to that, however hard, you know, we try to replicate it.
Do you think that ultimately, when you, if it is something that you intend to do or whatever, but when you have children, do you think you would have that same level of indoctrination? Would you try and recreate their experience? I think genuinely that, I mean, I grew up without a dad, so I didn't really have that that experience, which is why I'm an Evertonian and all my brothers are Liverpool fans.
Okay.
So, do you think it's fair? I know I think that's an unfair question. Will you try and recreate that experience for your children, do you think?
I'd like to think that I'm really forward thinking and liberal and will let them do what they want. That's a lovely idea, but probably not now. I'm probably gonna make them support Liverpool and they're gonna have to go to the game, yeah. Like, no, you can be into art, or you can, nah, just come to match with your dad.
I mean, just out of interest, let's say if we take a straw poll of 20 people listening to this podcast, what percent do you think will agree with you there?
I don't know.
I'd say 100.
Yeah.
But do you try and recreate that experience when you go to the match? Because it's hard to say, and this is going to sound like criticism, and it isn't, as you full well know it isn't.
Yeah.
But because of the success of Mundial, which is because of how hard you've worked,
your
experience of the games, judging by your Instagram, judging by your Twitter, it's more towards the middle of the ground rather than the end of the ground. Is that a fair way of saying that?
That's totally fair. And I'm not someone who's, I've never had a season ticket, you know what I mean? I'm not someone who goes to the European aways, and I never have been. I've always been to a good amount of games because my family go, and I've got mates who go, and I'll get tickets that way. So I'm not claiming to be Mr. Liverpool, and I don't think I ever have in that sense. I support Liverpool, and I'll go when I can, and when I can afford to. So when I get offered those tickets through brands that we work with and stuff, I'm gonna go. it's strange because, as Mundial, we were quite outspoken about how the game has changed in that manner. But if we don't take them, someone else is gonna be in those seats. If I get offered, do you want to go and watch Liverpool? Yeah. I'm gonna go. And I'm probably gonna upset someone from Nissan because I'm shouting or something like that. But the way I consume football has changed, but it's really nice to, when that's not the case and I do go with my mates or go with my dad or my grandmother or whatever, the experiences aren't as different as you'd expect. I think it's probably the best polite way to put it.
The last question I sort of asked you then is that when you see the bald eagle as he was known in Italian circles, will you forever associate Attilio Lombardo with someone getting twatted around the back of the head?
Yeah, I think so, which is probably unfair on poor Attilio. Achievement.
Career, what a career. Football. Scudettos, European Cups.
I've got this, he's the guy who brought Crystal Palace to Anfield, and two lads in a spray where he's got a clip around the back of the head. That's it. Winning the Champions League, but the moment I think which is the oddest one is the fact that Vladimir Smicha scored in a Champions League final, which is funny, isn't it?
I mean, is that more funny though than Jimmy Traore actually playing?
Yeah, probably not. But it was just the reason that I didn't go to Istanbul. I went to a good amount of the home games that season, but I was in the middle of my GCSEs, and it just wasn't happening. My mum wasn't having it. So I
can assure you, your teachers probably went.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If there's any Liverpool supporting teacher, yeah. Then.
But I watched it. Yeah, it was a family thing again. I was sat around, and my granddad, to this day, still thinks Smicha is crap, and he didn't like him at all. He just thought he was too lightweight, and he wasn't a Liverpool player. And the memory is just him getting on the edge of the box, and him going, "Don't shoot," and him hitting it and going in. And I'm just like falling about laughing, basically, that he kind of underestimated this player who he'd never really valued. And it was obviously, yeah, it's great, it's cool that you're probably as sick of hearing about it as anyone else that we won in 2005. But it's more that was a really nice moment that I kind of shared with family, because like we spoke about in the previous section was. They'd grown up seeing us do that, and they really took it for granted in the 80s and in the late 70s that they were winning stuff, but I'd never seen us do anything like that. And I remember my granddad saying, "I never thought I'd see that again," which is kind of a really nice thing that you did get to see. But yeah, that's it. Istanbul is my favourite football moment.
But specifically the Smicha, because it's the generation of football where, as you're saying, in your memory you started going. Smicha was the back end of that, the Houllier, Smicha, I think, is the epitome of the Houllier generation, where plenty of heart, plenty of, I'm played his part.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think he was as bad as...
My views do not represent...
It's important to stress that, like, he also didn't rate Pepe Reina, for example. He's probably the best goalkeeper we've had in about 15 years. So that's kind of by the by whether Smicha was actually good or not.
Yeah. I don't think your granddad's judgment is the barometer we need to go on here, is it? It seems that describe the night then. So you're 15 or 16, you've turned 16, so you're doing your GCSEs.
So
what was it like? Because I was in an environment that a kind of, there was people gone missing, and it was literally where's so-and-so? Oh, he's not feeling well. When we clearly knew full well he was on a flight to Turkey. and to see them slip into the morning meeting the next day was quite interesting. I think there were spies that basically had more trouble getting in other countries than these Liverpool fans did. So in the daytime, what was the build-up like for you? How did you feel?
I was just terrified, I think. Because
football,
because we like I said, I grew up watching us do well, and the Houllier years were great. I remember the 2001 and stuff like that. I remember us beating Roma at Anfield, take us to all those were great, but we'd like beating Juventus, and we were playing AC Milan. It was weird for me. It was like, this must be what it's like with what they've been going on about for years and years. But it was also like I grew up in Skem in Lancashire as well, so I was surrounded by Evertonians, some Manchester United fans who'd obviously been there and done that, and they were just like, "You're gonna get battered," and I kind of believed them. I was like, "Yeah, no, we're not that good. I don't think we're that good. But it's great, amazing that we got this far." But I was just scared that we were. It'd come a bit too soon for that side, and I was excited, but I was mainly just thinking, "Oh, shit." this is serious. This, everyone's going to see us. Kind of, if we mess this up, everyone's going to know about it.
It's going to be on the biggest club stage, isn't it?
Definitely.
So when the team was named, and from right and remembering, he went with Kuhl.
Yeah, Kuhl started.
Kuhl started, and Cisse came on for him.
Haman came.
No, because he didn't start Haman. Did he brought Haman on at half time?
So that was it. Again, another player who just kind of never never really lived up to his billing at Liverpool, high Q. You could just tell from moment one that he was as terrified as I was. He wasn't on it at all.
Well, he'd been carrying injuries, hadn't he? It was interesting. I interviewed Harry Kewell. I did a Crawley game last week, and it was looking at his figure. You know, I'm not that way inclined, but I was looking at his figure. I couldn't understand how he was ever a pro.
He's
tiny.
Oh really?
In his frame. Now he might obviously, you know, but it was interesting that he had all those calf injuries. And I was thinking, but still a really great player. Yeah. So when that team was named, what was your dad and your granddad feel?
I think there was, I don't remember exactly, but I think there was a lot of talk around, bloody hell, Harry Kewell starting. They rated, like, this is a perfect example, they rated him up because he was a Liverpool player. Yeah. He was sensible and he kept it on the floor. Yeah. And so they wanted him in the side, and obviously when you're 3-0 down, you bring him on, it's kind of, anything's a bonus. He could have come on and we could have lost 3-1 and it would have been a plus. So I feel like, but Harry Kewell just wasn't up to it, and that kind of added to the nerves of we're starting a Champions League finally, and that lad looks well out of his depth. Yeah. But there was also the element of we'd got this far playing Biscan and players like that and Jimmy Traore. So
the semi was Scott Carson and goal.
Yeah. So we knew that. We knew who was going to start or who was going to be there or thereabouts. And you look at the team and you go, okay, cool. Yeah, well, we're in Champions League final and we've got Jimmy Traore at the back. Let's see what happens. There was no we could have, we're not going to magic world-class players out of anywhere in that season. And you were just looking to Carragher and Gerrard to kind of pull it together, and they eventually got around to doing that.
Yeah. At half time, who was the biggest harbinger of doom?
My uncle went and stood in the garden.
He just went and stood in the garden, completely avoided.
He just left. I just remember kind of tying into what we expected before that. I just remember everyone just being like, I don't want to be embarrassed. Yeah. I mean, let's get that Nick one back, and let's look like we've actually done something. And it was it's good. My dad's got two brothers. The younger one stayed in. The older one went out and smoked furiously in the garden for and then until our first goal, and then we made them stay out there because it was a good luck thing.
Yeah, and rightly so. There seems to be a big thing at the moment. If you can't support a team in the worst times, you don't deserve to support the best time. But if you can take that and apply it to absolutely ridiculous situations. So, for example, if he'd sat on the roof, and then you score, he stays on the roof.
Exactly.
Best way for it. Was there anyone in the room saying, even before the first goal went in, because I think you got the first goal back quite quickly, within first 5 minutes of...
I think, 50, 55 or something like that.
Time enough to think. Was there anyone prior to that goal going in saying, in the words of, I think it's Mike Somerby, or is it Bobby Moore in Escape to Victory, we can do this?
Absolutely not. my mates who went and family members who were out there, all these stories of... And he was thinking, you'll never walk alone at half time. That did happen. Yeah. It didn't happen in my uncle's house. This is crap. We're goose there. There was no rallying cry or anything. It was literally, let's try and not get embarrassed. Let's lose 3-2 if we can.
let's have typical English glorious failure.
Yeah.
We're sat currently in quite low seats here, which, considering I've been in the gym this morning and done quite a lot of squat work, it's starting to sort of thing. So if we use this as a barometer, first goal, you're up a bit.
Yeah.
Second goal, you're up a bit more. When the third goal went in, describe, what was the order again? Was Smeecher's second or was Smeecher?
Yeah, Stephen Gerrard, header, Smeecher, and Xabi Alonso penalty.
Then follow up, obviously, because he actually missed the pen, didn't he? When he missed the pen.
Yeah.
Did you have time to react?
I think so. I think there was a bit of a you soft bastard about it. I think there was something like that. And then, it was a bit like, as he's scoring it, we're all kind of reacting to him missing it. And it all got a bit confusing. And that moment was a little bit lost. But I don't think you could draw a graph, because it was like, when we scored the first, it was like, oh, okay. Oh, well, that's interesting. Obviously, it's Steven Gerrard doing it for us. Obviously, he's kind of, and he's running back to the centre circle with the ball. Okay, maybe. The second one's Smicha, so we're all dealing with that.
That's just that side of the game.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then I think after that second one, it's a very Martin Tyler thing, but it was like, all right, yeah, this probably ours. This you could see Milano just like, oh god. And as you well know, as an Everton fan, when things are going Liverpool's way, they just go our way. It was like, okay.
It's because of that long-term contract you signed with the devil about 30, 40 years ago.
Once that pendulum kind of swung with that second goal in particular, it was like, all right, we won this now, I think. I think we're going to win this trophy.
There's three crucial factors in the game. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, we've got into, I think we've got like into nearly 10 minutes, 13 minutes of this. We haven't mentioned Benitez.
Yeah.
Does Benitez get the credit today because you kind of say he picked that team in the first place, but
yeah,
what else could he do?
Yeah, he can do no wrong in my eyes. for the reason we were talking about before is Julio was great and he kind of got us nearly there, but he got us there. He fulfilled Benitez. Got me within touching distance of what my dad and my granddad and his dad and everyone had kind of felt. So it was like, this is Liverpool again now. And he did that. Whether it was his team or whether it was, whether he made some stupid signings or whatever, it doesn't, regardless. Like we said before, it's the emotion that matters with football, not money spent or any of that nonsense. He can do no wrong. And I think if you speak to most Liverpool fans, apart from really grumpy ones, I think he does. He gets the credit. He gets the credit for that final, along with Carragher and Gerrard and JJ Dudek.
Well, we'll come on to Dudek in a minute. But do you think it grates on Gerrard a little bit, just a little bit? That yes, he was outstanding second half, and really, I'm gonna have to gonna have to do some killing or something to get through that. No, I'm joking. Do you think it grates a little bit on Gerrard that he had to do all that from right back? Or is it a sign that he's that good that he could influence a game from right back?
I think that's season, just take away from the final from it, that season's a weird one for him. He was injured and he didn't play. I think it was Juventus away, he didn't play. We went to Juventus with Biscan in the middle of the park, which again is hilarious. I don't know. No, I think, like you said, him playing out of position all season or doing this or doing that and it not quite going right, but him ending up lifting the trophy anyway is probably perfect. Kind of Roy the Rovers, Steven Gerrard, that year. That's probably better.
Yeah.
That's probably, like, for his narrative, that's better than it all going perfectly. Because it was never going to do that. He wasn't surrounded by the players to have kind of like a... like Chelsea last season where they just grind it out. That wasn't possible. So all those factors, his injury, playing out of position or whatever, that's better.
He kind of took the long route to the success rather than the route. And Didier Mann, I mean, again, Didier Mann is a player I've got grudging respect for as a player.
Yes.
Because Wenger, I think, Arsene Wenger, often forgets that sometimes the dirty side of football is just as nice as the nice side of football. And there was no better sight than Didier Mann getting between man and ball and hitting the deck as he picked up a cheap free kick.
And he
just gave you that. He gave you that stability really in the second half, didn't he?
Yeah, to
get Alonso further up the pitch.
Yeah, to let players like.
Sorry for some football chat to break out here. Like,
but... it's all right. I suppose we had to get onto it eventually. It's cliche, but he gave Alonso and Gerrard that freedom to not have to be tracking back and covering for our rugby defence and stuff. They got to be the buccaneering, exciting midfielders that where they were at their best. And he was great. Yeah, he was an old pro even then, and just knew when to, like you said, to get a cheap free kick or when to just put it out for a throw in and all those stupid things that you. Players don't really get credit anymore in the super modern game where it's all about XG and stuff like that.
I'd like to know what that means, but I don't. So it's 3-3. Alonso scored, and you've kind of you are literally back to square one, as the old saying goes. But the Dudek save. What was the reaction?
What was we thought he'd scored.
Is that?
I think that the when he hits it the first time and he saves it, it's like, oh, and it comes straight back out to him. It's like, because again, in that room, Shevchenko is untouchable because they all know who he is. Like, he's great. Him, I've seen him on this, and this, and yeah. He used to play for this. So he's a proper player, him like Pirlo was, and like Yapstam and stuff. They knew enough about them to feel like they could. And myself included, yeah, he's proper. He's a great striker. So he scored, like, as far as we're concerned, that's going in. And I don't know. I still don't know how it stayed out to this day. But yeah, I'm glad. So
it's an interesting one to say that, because Ian McIntosh's podcast at the start of the series, we talk about Gazza in '96, and he 21 years later, and I'm the same. We still expect Gasco to score.
Oh, really?
At the back post.
On it. Yeah.
So if I was to put YouTube in front of you now and the ball, Dudek's made his first save, do you still expect?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you're watching, you go like, he's fallen away from the ball. I think it goes over the bar. I don't know how he changes the direction of it so much that it goes over the bar. It's insane. But it kind of, again, it just ties into that plucky Liverpool narrative, doesn't it, of us. Oh, wow. Andrei Shevchenko's missed from 3 yards. Of course, he has. It's also again. Yeah.
If the camera then cuts over to the script writers and they've got their arms up going, nah, we've had enough now. We've had enough.
Yeah.
You come to penalties. Mm. Do you generally? It's very hard not to have hindsight from 12 years on. But do you think? Yeah, it's us.
I don't really remember the penalties. I think it was if in the second half when we scored our third goal, I think our name's on Sophie. Everything after that is a bit like, oh god, like just wrapped with tension. I don't really remember them. I remember him doing the grab of our legs because they loved that.
Yeah,
and that is again like the nice sentimental thing about it. It was like, oh wow, yeah, great, okay. But then that's about it. I don't really. And look at that team. There's not many people you want taking a penalty there in the Liverpool team. I don't know. I think
I could probably name three.
I think Haman probably took one.
Did he? Actually, he wouldn't have been. I'd have said Gerrard definitely did. Who missed? Didn't Alonso miss?
Maybe. I don't know. I can't remember.
Write in, listeners. Write in and tell us. But I remember Cissé. Did Cissé?
Yes. Oh, was that? Was he playing? I don't know.
Cissé definitely come on. So
yeah,
I remember.
But
it was again. It was Dudek because it wasn't a slotted penalty. Dudek saved the penalty.
Yeah, it was the Shevchenko penalty. Yeah. So he really, really ruined that lad's night. Like.
It was weird.
I think again there was someone in the garden. I don't think they wanted to watch. I think that there was a lot of people behind pillows in the house and stuff. I also remember like no one really drinking, which is weird.
Yeah.
We were around someone's house and I was only 16 or whatever. But when you're watching the match, there's people drinking. But I just think it was literally just.
It was the same. It was the same in our house. Yeah. I watched it with my brothers and. I don't think he doesn't work at that school anymore anyway. But they had a projector, so we watched it on a white wall. And I was driving and all that by then. And as soon as the penalty went in, I got off.
Fair play to you.
But I think it was the same. And I mean, is it? And I ask this 100% seriously, so I fully expect you to answer it 100% seriously.
Yeah.
Is that European Cup win? Is the shine taken off by the fact that? Joselu was right next to Gerrard when he lifted the trophy.
there is a bit of a, if you look back at the photos, bloody hell, what's he doing? Like, who's that? Who's, you know, what? Even Cissé, you know what I mean? Like, good player, whatever, but what's he doing? He's enjoying that too much, as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think there was an element, though, of, because I know you got the final 2 years later.
Yeah.
Again against Milan, but it went more like a proper game, and I think that's probably why you lost.
Yeah.
Do you think there was an element though that, and this isn't me having a dig before, because I remember writing something for the Alpha Rap.
Yeah.
And people piled in on me, but do you think there was an element of that was almost like the pinnacle, not the start?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. It should have. that should have kickstarted Benitez's idea for it, because as I said, it wasn't his side. But it's pretty hard act to follow, isn't it?
Yeah.
When the FA Cup the next year.
Well, I was going to say, the FA Cup next year, though, was
it, there was, it felt like a bit of an anticlimax. Yeah, I was at that. I'm pretty sure I was at that. And it was great, but it did feel like, okay.
Yeah.
And it was, again, it was a weird Royal Rovers style. We've got through. But yeah, I think everyone expected us to go on and be back in finals and winning them and winning, you know, challenging for the league and stuff instantly. And it wasn't. It was
4 years later, I think, 2009, yeah, when you finished second.
Yeah, he start, you know, that was, he went and started to rebuild the team. It wasn't a progression thing. It wasn't, yeah, like, cool, we'll build on that. It was like, all right, that's out of the way. Now here's my plan for what we're going to do for the next 5-6 years.
And it ties in what you said at the start, is that that team was probably not ready, yeah, for anything, really.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
The sort of last thing I'd say then is, did your uncle ever come back in? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. Maybe not, actually.
No, I mean now is he?
he's still smoking in the garden. Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, though, I couldn't tell you when. Like, that's the weird, surreal thing about it. I can remember how low Steve Finnan's socks were, but I can't remember. Like, can't remember what happened in the room. What like the snippets, but it's all very surreal. It's also a long time ago now, which is worth knowing.
But ultimately, isn't that how football should be?
Yeah, I think so. Like before, I remember someone slapping someone on the back of the head. I remember a snippet of what my granddad said, but I don't remember who took the penalties. And I think that's perfect.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have it any other way.